And articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading some articles from the January 2024 issue of Cowboys and Indians magazine. The River Has Its Destination by the CMI Writers. Welcome to our first issue of 2024. As you page through each story, you might notice a few changes here and there. CNI has been going strong for 3 decades now, and we like to update our wardrobe every so often. For our entire staff, as well as the many writers, editors, photographers, and contributors to this magazine, it's an exciting time to freshen up the way we tell stories. The word storyteller is one that gets thrown around a lot, but to CNI, it's a role essential to the spirit and culture of the American West. It is fundamental to the Western lifestyles we live and breathe. Whether it happens on a reservation, around a campfire, or on a front porch, or at the office, stories are passed down from one generation to the next. There's been one constant storyteller at the heart of our publication for more than half its existence. This month, editorial director Dana Joseph marks 20 years at CNI. In that time, she has stepped up to lead, stepped back to let others shine, and always championed the people, places, and diverse cultures of the American West. She is the constant, a font of knowledge and source of wisdom for those seeking a steady hand on the journey ahead. And amid the rapidly changing media landscape, her guidance brings to mind a verse from the well-known prophecy told by Hopi elders entitled, "We are the ones we've been waiting for." There is a river flowing now very fast. It is so great and swift that there are those who will be afraid. They will try to hold on to the shore. They will feel they are being torn apart and will suffer greatly. No, the river has its destination. The elders say we must let go of the shore, push off into the middle of the river, keep our eyes open and our heads above the water. From editors past and present, we thank Dana for encouraging us to let go of the shore and trust the river. What better lesson, or resolution, could we take forth into this new year? The Voice of the Prairie. Cotterwald's little songs feel lived in because he lives them. His Saskatchewan ranch is as important to him as his celebrated cowboy music. By Anna Lapinto. It's an early summer afternoon in the southwest corner of Saskatchewan. Singer-songwriter Coulter Wall sits on the bed of his F-350 in the middle of the Canadian prairie at his ranch, the Rafter CW, where he runs a yearling cattle operation. There's a daunting pile of scrap posts next to him. "I inherited them with the place," he says with a chuckle. Several drought-resistant Caragana trees edging the property, and a nice set of steel corrals with a loading chute set in the back. Wall's ranch sits on the northern end of the Great Plains. Covering 1 million square miles, the plains are a massive swath of land roughly encompassing the Llano Estacado in northwestern Texas to the bottom of the prairie provinces of Canada, running west of the 100th meridian to the eastern edge of the Rockies. In modern times, it's a place that's often overlooked, mistakenly seen as a conglomeration of flyover states and provinces, but it shouldn't be. It's a landscape with a dramatic story from the Western lore of immigrant and cattle trails of the 19th century to its ecological significance as one of the most endangered ecosystems in the world. For Wall, it's home. I'm predisposed to the openness and the emptiness of the prairie, he says. If you grow up in this kind of country, I think you either come to hate it, you think it's boring, there's nothing out here, just this big open country that goes on forever, not even a tree to look at. Or if you're like me, you find comfort in it. Wall's sense of place and deep appreciation for the prairie is so ingrained in him that his recent album, Little Songs, pays homage to it. Where Wall's previous works have celebrated cowboy culture, Little Songs retains that reverence, but now with an equal dose of reality. A reality that is difficult to incorporate without experiencing firsthand, something Wall is distinctly aware of. This is everyday life for those farming and ranching. I like to think of myself as one of them, of course, but what I do, in comparison, is pretty small and insignificant. But I live with these people and we work together. These people are my neighbors. In Little Songs, Wall explores drought, wind, depression, the financial burdens of running a ranching operation, and isolation, with lyrics that resonate on a visceral level. When in the title track, Little Songs, he sings about a woman fighting drought and her own mind, day by day she's been losing to the wind. I go back to a memory on the high desert in the San Luis Valley of Colorado. I was moving cattle on horseback, pulling my hat down to my brow in desperation as a windstorm pelted grains of sand violently at my face. Riding next to me, my friend had a defeated look in his eyes as he cussed at the weather. By the end of the week, he had withdrawn completely. The extreme wind had kicked his anxiety into high gear. As I recount the story to Wall, he is empathetic. The prairie can be maddening. There's an area west here in the hills called Mary Flat. The story goes that the early settlers lost their minds in it. It's really tough country. In addition to the accurate vignettes of agrarian life, the title track features Roy Nicholas' guitar, picking and intimate, sitting right next to you, dry vocals. This song, production-wise, leans closer to barroom country than campfire western, and lyrically, half a nod to Canadian singer Ian Tyson, and half to rural women of the West. Ian's fluent influence crept into this song and the entire album. I wrote this when he was alive, and then he went ahead and died. It's kind of almost spooky thing. Wall's right. The line, "There's an old man in the foothills, if he ain't dead, he's living there still," now has prophetic energy. Wall further pays tribute to Tyson in his rendition of The Coyote and the Cowboy, a cheeky recording with one sly lyric edit, a swap of Old Long Noose Saloon to Old Jasper Saloon, his local watering hole. Why artists choose specific songs to cover is telling, and it's difficult not to appreciate Wall's choice here. An admiration for one of the West's most misunderstood and often detested animals, the coyote. The Coyote and the Cowboy and Evangelina are the two covers on the album. Both are thoughtful musical interpretations of Wall's predecessors and a fine example of his historical reverence and legwork. However, the standouts on this album are his originals. Corralling the blues is a rare moment of vulnerability. With sparse melancholy instrumentation and patient phrasing, The emotive tune is arguably one of the most significant songs in Wall's catalog, with lyrics like, "It's a feeling I have known since before I was grown. I'm howling, corralling the blues." Wall speaks plainly about mental health. While Little Songs has its pensive moments, it has celebratory ones too. The types of songs that elicit an instant kinetic response from the listener, be it a sly tap of the foot or a proud turn in the dance hall. Honky Tonk Nighthawk is one of those nostalgic country songs that places the listener squarely on a bar stool at a dance hall, like the Broken Spoke in Austin. You can see the neon lights glowing through a hazy window, smell the sawdust on the floor, laugh at the posters of George Strait covered in lipstick, and admire the older couple wearing well-earned trophy buckles and fine felt Stetsons, moving together with decades of familiarity. There are so many great dance halls and old bars in Texas, and I took full advantage of that. I did some drinking and dancing in those cool places and wrote this song for one of the mornings after. From the bar room to the branding pen, Wall's music encompasses many iterations of Western traditions. Honky Tonk Nighthawk was explicitly written as a dance tune and borrowed heavily from string band traditions. Musically, that song ended up being a nod to Western swing and Texas music, specifically Bob Wells. The opening lick is the old Milk Cow Blues fiddle lick. The song pays tribute to the old Western swing, which is a nice way of saying ripping it off, Wall says with a laugh. Wall has a history with Texas, from cowboying at his friend's ranches to selling out famed dance halls like Billy Bob's in Fort Worth. He chose the Lone Star State to record Little Songs at Yellow Dog Studios in Wimberley, which he was partial to because of the scenic hill country, proximity to the Pecos River, and bunkhouse-style accommodations. Where his first EP, Imaginary Appalachia, was portraying a supposed life in Little Songs, Wall is sharing his lived reality. This intimacy is squarely placing him among the literary and songwriter greats of North American West, and more specifically, those with a deep appreciation of the plains like Willa Cather, Larry McMurtry, Laura Ingalls Wilder, Ian Fraser, and Wallace Stegner. His catalog is being utilized in many modern television westerns, including Deadwood and Yellowstone. With these songs, I'm writing about it because I have experienced it. I'm in the thick of it, and I'm glad to be, with all the troubles and the things that come with it. Wall heads off to check for algae in his heifer's stock tanks to get back to his life on the prairie, to fill the big empty with Little Songs.
Hello, this is Michael, and I am reading True West Magazine, History of the American Frontier, December 2023 edition. The Highest Peak by Henry C. Park. Best of the Mountain Man movies. On the eve of the release of The Revenant, inspired by the true story of Hugh Glass's fight for life, the film rights to the character of Grizzly Adams are up for bid. Across the country, hipsters dubbed lumber sexuals are sprouting facial hair and sporting flannel and buckskin. Why the sudden appeal of the mountain man? Maybe because neither Grizzly Adams nor Hugh Glass ever said, "It takes a village." As Charlton Heston's character says in 1980's The Mountain Men, "I can still walk for a year in any direction with just my rifle and a handful of salt and never have to say sir to nobody. I reckon that's free." Charlton's son, Fraser, who wrote the film, understands the appeal of the self-confident, independent man. It's an archetypical Western, prototypical, really. It's an early version of America's drive west, before the country was settled, before there were gunslingers and ranchers and farmers and towns with sidewalks. The men who cut the paths that became wagon routes for the pioneers have long fascinated film goers and filmmakers. Here are 10 Mountain Man movies worth seeking out. Number 1, the 1971 Western Man in the Wilderness, Warner Archive. The first cinematic telling of the ordeal of Hugh Glass stars Richard Harris as part of a grand trapper expedition. Horribly mauled by a grizzly, sure to die, the expedition's captain, John Huston, leaves two men behind to bury him, but fearing that Indians are coming, they abandon him. Yet he survives, driven by memories of his family, to try and catch up. Number 2, Jeremiah Johnson, Warner Archive. Features Robert Redford as a Mexican-American war veteran determined to make a life in the Rocky Mountains. Sidney Pollack's direction and John Milas and Edward Anhalt's script for the 1972 film create a man who, while speaking rarely, is accessible, romantic, and terrifying in his wrath, although the film tactfully skirts why he was known as Liver-Eating Johnson. Number 3, Clint Walker on hiatus from Cheyenne gave the screen's most clean-shaven mountain man in 1959's Yellowstone Kelly, Warner Archive. Supported by fellow Warner Brothers, TV stars Ed Burns and John Russell's characters, Kelly must protect the Sioux and his own trap lines from dangerously ambitious soldiers. He must also safeguard a beautiful Arapaho captive desired by both the Sioux chief and his ambitious nephew. Number 4, The Life and Times of Grizzly Adams. A tiny-budget, sound-dubbed in 1974 film was such a success that it begat a slew of wilderness family films, as well as a TV series for its star, Dan Haggerty. Falsely accused of murder, Adams disappears into the mountains, lives off the land, and raises a grizzly. Sometimes dismissed as Jeremiah Johnson Light, the film has great beauty and charm. Haggerty remembers fondly, a lot of people don't know that the California state flag is a representation of his bear. We did kind of a softened version of his life. Couldn't do it hard and heavy in those days, the way James Capon Adams lived, but that's how it was. Number 5, the most filmed mountain man portrayal is of Albert Johnson, the Mad Trapper of Rat River, filmed 4 times in 9 years. The 1978 comedy went unfinished. In 1931, Inuits complained that Johnson was meddling with their traps. Mountie confrontations with Johnson led to them leveling his cabin with dynamite. When the smoke cleared, Johnson ran out, guns blazing, and the legendary Yukon manhunt began. The engrossing 1981 actioner Death Hunt, Shout Factory, starring Charles Bronson as Johnson and Lee Marvin as the Mountie determined to catch him, is by far the best. A new version has been announced for 2017. Number 6, Charlton Heston and Brian Keith star in the salty and savage 1980 film The Mountain Men, Amazon Video. An adventure story with plenty of humor and heart. Screenwriter Fraser Heston recalls, "Our story takes place in the 1830s, at the end of the fur trade era. The heyday was past, so there's a feeling already of nostalgia for something that is lost." Victoria Racimo plays the Indian woman Hester's trapper character does not want, but grows to love. Stephen Macht is Heavy Eagle, who will not give her up. Among the high points is the trapper's rendezvous sequence, an event Fraser describes as part trade show and part rave in buckskins. Number 7. In Wild Bill, Wellman's 1951 flick Across the Wide Missouri, Warner Archive, Flint Mitchell, played by Clark Gable, bargains for a Blackfoot bride, Maria Elena Marquez, for trade reasons, assembles a battalion of fellow trappers, and leads them into rich beaver grounds. Mitchell finds himself loving his wife and her people, and he becomes drawn into a power struggle between her grandfather, Bear Ghost, played by Jack Holt, and Iron Shirt, played by Ricardo Montalban. Number 8. Anthony Mann's 1955 Western, The Last Frontier, Sony Pictures, is a fascinating story of three cultures clashing: military, Lakota, and mountain man. When Red Cloud forces three trappers out, they scout for the nearby fort. As arrogant Colonel Marston, played by Robert Preston, drives the two sides inevitably to war, Victor Mature is the savage innocent of the trappers, who naively makes a play for Anne Bancroft's character, not caring that she's the colonel's wife. Number 9. In 1969's My Side of the Mountain, Ted Eccles plays a 12-year-old boy obsessed with Henry David Thoreau and science, who runs away to live in the mountains of Canada and tries to create a new food source from algae. He also catches and trains a peregrine falcon, skins deer to make his clothes, and befriends an itinerant folk singer played by Theodore Bichel. Number 10. I'm jumping the gun, including The Revenant, in the top 10 list. As we go to press, I've only seen the trailer, but what a trailer and what a story. Between the celebrated novel by professional diplomat Michael Punk, the direction by last year's Oscar winner for Birdman, Alejandro González, Iñárritu, photography by double Oscar winner for 2014's Birdman and 2013's Gravity, Emmanuel Lubezki, and performances by Leonardo DiCaprio and Tom Hardy, it should be on the top of your must-see list. Due out as a limited release this Christmas and then nationwide on January 8th. The Revenant stars DiCaprio as real-life frontiersman Hugh Glass, who gets mauled by a bear and left to die by his hunting companions. He sets out on a 200-mile trek to avenge this betrayal. True West Magazine, December 2023 edition. The Hawk and Rifle Turns 200 by Phil Spangenberger. Just as the Colt revolver and the Winchester rifle are icons of the post-Civil War West, one gun symbolizes the era of the fur trade. The rifle was the primary weapon for sustenance and defense with the early trappers and explorers in the American West. Although specific firearms makers are seldom mentioned in accounts left by these frontiersmen, we do know they initially carried the delicately fashioned Eastern flintlocks, guns like the graceful brass-fitted Kentucky Long Rifle, 44 to 46 inches in length, style with slender curly maple stocks and bore sizes of around 40 to 45 caliber, or the slightly heavier and simpler unadorned or iron-mounted walnut-stocked 45 to 50 caliber Southern or Tennessee rifles were the norm. If that wasn't long enough, before they discovered that these smaller caliber guns were inadequate for the big game encountered in the Far West, especially for longer range shooting, which was common in the Western mountains and plains, gradually these long rifles were modified by shortening and strengthening with a thicker stock, stronger lock, reboring the barrel, or replacing it with a shorter, heavier one of 50 or greater caliber. In the burgeoning Western fur trade, the most convenient jumping-off locale for these trans-Missouri River traders was St. Louis, which had become the center of all business involved with the frontier. A number of gunsmiths were prospering there, largely through the Indian trade, and by modifying and repairing Eastern guns to meet the demands of the rugged mountains, one of them, Jacob Jake Hawken, a gunsmith who arrived in St. Louis in 1807, eventually opened his own shop on Main Street in 1815, and by 1819 was evidently partnered with gunsmith James Lakenan. By 1825, with the death of Lakenan, Jake's younger brother Samuel had joined up with him, resulting in the J&S Hawken Partnership, which lasted for the next 24 years. The timing and location was perfect for them, since their partnering coincided with the beginnings of the Santa Fe trading and the founding of the major fur companies, Ashley and Henry Fur Company, the Rocky Mountain Fur Company, the American Fur Company, and others. Initially, the brothers kept busy working on individual customers' rifles. They had shortened and strengthened their older long rifles to suit hard usage in the West. Ultimately, the brothers began supplying their own unique big game rifles to the large outfits as well as individual free trappers. Although these Hawkins, as they were referred to in several written accounts of the period, were not necessarily better than other rifles of the era, their ruggedness, uniform workmanship, and performance soon earned the brothers a reputation as makers of fine mountain rifles. The Hawken rifle became the hands-down favorite of frontiersmen like Christopher Kit Carson, Jim Bridger, James P. Beckworth, Jediah Smith, Hugh Glass, and many other mountain men, scouts, and traders of the early West. The early Hawken rifles were believed to be flintlocks with full-length stocks, but without any maker stampings. Positive identification is difficult, and no guns that turned up that can be definitively verified as Hawken's made. There is a bit of controversy as to whether Hawken ever made flint irons, but many armed scholars believe that quite a number of them were indeed produced, and numerous records of purchases from the Hawkins by these major fur traders as early as the 1820s offers evidence of Hawken rifle production. Due to the hard use and primitive circumstances they endured, coupled with the early timing of their service life, few, if any, have survived. In the last decade, a heavy mountain rifle that's been converted from flintlock to percussion and bearing J.P. Beckworth's verified engraved signature under the barrel has been found that has the earmarks of what would make an early Hawken, and Beckworth was known to have favored Hawkins from their earliest production. It's believed that Hawken began turning out percussion rifles most likely in the late 1830s, and by this time, with the exception of a few customer requests, the majority of Hawken rifle characteristics were fairly standardized for the rest of their production. When Jake Hawken died of cholera in 1849, Sam took over the business and stamped his guns S. Hawken, St. Louis, although he reportedly kept the J&S lock plate and barrel stamping for a short while after Jake's death. Sam ran the shop until 1862 when he sold it to employee John P. Gimmer, who eventually used his own stamping on his Hawken-style guns. Original Hawkins we encounter today are mostly post-1840 rifles, dating from those years through the 1860s, and saw most of their use out on the plains after the end of the fur trade in the mountains. Briefly, Jake, then J&S Hawken, supplied the fur trappers with the hardy rifle they needed. The Hawken was the first muzzle loader specifically designed for long-range knockdown power on Western big game. When the beaver market plummeted in 1840, the year of the last Western rendezvous, the Hawken continued to appeal to a new group of customers. These, later produced at S. Hawken front loaders, along with several other St. Louis-made mountain rifle markers, makers turned out guns along the lines of Brother Jacob's simple but classic Hawken. Great quantities of them were sold to the next generation of Westerners, the scouts, guides, meat hunters, and other adventurers who opened the frontier. Hawkins and their like were now called Plains rifles, since they were primarily used on the plains during the surge of westward immigration in the 1850s to the 70s. These new frontiersmen, and the Indians too, wanted that same powerful, long-range armament that had earned lasting fame before in the Rockies. Even for a number of years after the introduction of metallic cartridge breech holders, like the 5070 Allen Conversion Springfield and the Sharps, the Hawken remained a frontier favorite. Now celebrating its 200th anniversary, the Hawken rifle has become known as the Mountain Rifle, and possibly enjoys as much fame today as in the past, with muzzle-loading hunters and sports shooters in a variety of configurations, some authentic to the originals, others take great license in shape and details. It's no wonder the state of Missouri has recently passed a bill making the Hawken the official state rifle. When one thinks of the mountain man of old, it's often in the image of a rugged and hard-bitten buckskin and fur-clad trapper of the high country, cradling the classic old-time Hawken rifle in his arms. That's a true icon. Typical Hawken characteristics. A typical Hawken has an octagonal barrel measuring 1 1/8 inches or more across the flats and could be 34 to 36 inches in length. Originally, a browned barrel is held to the stock by a pair of keys. Bore sizes run 32 inches, round balls, to the pound, 53 caliber, or greater. All furniture and mountings are iron. A plain darkened maple or walnut half stock with a raised cheekpiece on its left side and a somewhat thick wrist replaces the full-length stock of the earlier guns. The barrel is fitted with an under rib running from the forestock to the muzzle and holds the ferrules for the ramrod or wiping stick. Guns are generally devoid of a patch box or other inlays, as seen on the Pennsylvania-style long rifles. It wears a crescent-shaped butt plate, a patent breech, and double-set triggers housed inside a unique trigger guard with a curled tang. Buckhorn open sights are standard fare. The barrel or lock plate may or may not be stamped J&S Hawken or S. Hawken St. Louis. Weight is around 10.5 to 12 pounds. True West Magazine, December 2023 edition. Wyoming Cowboy Cuisine by Sherry Monahan. From beef steak to bear sign donuts, the state is well known for its bunkhouse fare. Wyoming is known as the Cowboy State, and cattle ranches dotted its landscape. Where there were cows, there were cowboys. They had their own language and culture, and their influence can still be seen all over Wyoming with rodeos, annual events, and their food. Cowboys' diets often included beef, biscuits, beans, coffee, and occasionally a little something sweet. It was often up to the cowboys to cook their meals in the bunkhouse, but those who lived on small ranches often took their meals with the family in the main house. Cowboys living on the bigger ranches were sometimes invited to the big house, that is, the boss's house, for meals on special occasions, like Christmas. Beef, not surprisingly, was eaten at the ranches, in homes, and at hotels and restaurants. Items included boiled beef heart with tomato sauce, roast sirloin au jus, boiled ox tongue with mushroom sauce, prime rib, braised sweetbreads, roast beef, and a hamburger steak patty. The steak patty was formed into an even round and cooked on a broiler grill and topped with a tomato sauce that included tomatoes, flowers, butter, onion, cloves, salt, and cayenne pepper. The steak was served on a platter, and it was surrounded by parsley and topped with the sauce. In The Log of a Cowboy, 1903, Andy Adams recalled his Christmas while he was working on the range in Wyoming. Well, 3 days before Christmas, just when things were looking gloomiest, there drifted up from the Cheyenne country one of the old-timers. He had been working out in the Panhandle country, New Mexico, and the devil knows where, since he had left that range. The old-timer recalled his last Christmas when he was taught to make what he called bear sign, or donuts, for the ranch hands. He told Andy, "Well, fellows, you ought to have seen them. Just sweet enough, brown to a turn, and enough to last a week." They were so impressed with the story that they made him stay on and make bear sign for their outfit through the spring, Adams wrote. After dinner, our man threw off his overshirt, unbuttoned his red undershirt, and turned it in until you could see the hair on his breast. Rolling up his sleeves, he flew at his job once more. He rolled his dough, cut his dough, and turned out the fine brown bear sign to the satisfaction of all. Recipe: bear sign, B-E-A-R sign, donuts. Ingredients: 1 3/4 cup flour sifted, 2 teaspoons baking powder, 1/2 teaspoon salt, 1/2 teaspoon baking soda, 3/4 cup sugar, 1 egg beaten, 1/2 cup buttermilk, 1 tablespoon butter melted, 4 cups oil or lard for frying. Sift the dry ingredients into a large bowl. In a separate bowl, beat the egg and sugar until blended. Add the milk to the egg and sugar, and then the melted butter. As you mix, the dough should become firm enough to roll. Do not overmix the dough, or it will become tough. Lightly dust the rolling surface with flour and roll out part of the dough into about 1/4 inch thick. Cut with a donut cutter or shape into donuts. Heat the oil in a deep pot and add enough oil or lard so the donuts will float. The oil should be 350 to 375 degrees. Gently drop the donuts into the fat and allow to rise. Flip and cook for about 1 to 2 minutes longer. Remove to paper towels and allow to cool. Frost with your favorite topping or dip into powdered sugar or cinnamon sugar. Adapted from Wyoming's The Sundance Gazette, September 20th, 1889. True West Magazine, December 2023 edition. Grizzlies of the Far West by James B. Mills. Before the legendary bear was nearly driven to extinction, Urus horribilis ruled the forests and plains of the Pacific coast. The American Indians who resided in the Mount Shasta region of Northern California believed the Great Spirit had created the grizzly bear to serve as master over all other animals. Many a white man who settled on the west coast of the United States may have been inclined to agree with them when laying eyes on such a large and dangerous mammal. In attacking a man, he usually rises on his hind legs, strikes his enemy with one of his powerful forepaws, and then commences to bite him, one newspaper man warned in 1863. His weight and strength are so great that he bears down all opposition before him, and he is very quick. About half a dozen men, on average, are killed yearly in California by grizzly bears, and as many more are cruelly mutilated. Grizzly encounters. While many folks did their best to avoid such a potentially gruesome encounter with Urus horribilis, some men would achieve a momentary fame by taking on the frontier's most feared carnivore. Joel Westfall became one of them when hunting a grizzly bear that had recently feasted on one of his prized sows near his home on the Merced River in Central California in early January 1861. The vengeful hog farmer grabbed his blankets and weapons before boldly setting up camp near his slain pig's meaty carcass and awaiting the large predator's return. Westfall waited long into the night until finally deciding to catch a nap. He was soon awakened by some ominous grunting sounds and quickly spotted a large shadow approaching in the moonlight. Joel Westfall had barely grasped his rifle before a large grizzly bear was merely 10 feet away. When the Bruin suddenly raised its head and began curiously sniffing the air, the hog farmer seized the moment and fired a shot into the animal's throat. He then dived under his blankets and lay motionless as the slowly dying grizzly tore up the surrounding underbrush in a desperate rage. The Bruin finally succumbed to its wound more than 20 minutes later. Westfall breathed a sigh of relief and emerged from beneath his blankets. He was astonished by the dead animal's girth. Now, if there is any other man in this state who, 10 miles from any accessible human habitation, would camp upon a trail of a grizzly bear going to his midnight repast and take the desperate chances of a fight with him, we should like to know who he is, the Costa Contra Gazette declared on January 19, 1861. The reports of Westfall's successful hunt reached as far as Maryland, Wisconsin, Massachusetts, and Georgia. Benjamin Harrison Baird would not prove as fortunate as Joel Westfall when he encountered a grizzly bear while hunting deer on Grave Creek in Jacksonville County, Oregon, on October 28, 1864. The 55-year-old farmer was hunting for game that morning when his faithful dog, Rover, began barking at a female grizzly bear and her two cubs lying on a bed of grass, leaves, and moss near the trail. The foolhardy bear slowly approached the three mammals rather than wisely backing away and took steady aim with his rifle from a distance of 15 yards. Baird quickly realized his mistake after squeezing the trigger and merely wounding the large female. The farmer was soon running for his life as the protective mother chased after him with a vengeance. The enraged female grizzly caught up with B.H. Baird after chasing him for 200 yards and knocked the rifle from his grasp. The desperate farmer managed to reach a nearby tree when the Bruin began fighting with his dog, but only further angered the large bear when, gathering up his rifle, he shot her for a second time. When the grizzly charged at Bear with even more ferocity, the farmer sprinted behind a thicket and drew his knife. He later claimed to have stabbed the animal in the belly before getting struck by several vicious blows. The grizzly began mauling the screaming farmer, ripping into his left side with her powerful claws, sinking her teeth into the right side and legs, gouging out his right eye, and biting all the flesh from the right side of his face. The bear then resumed fighting with Bear's dogs Rover, and the two snarling animals disappeared down a hillside. B.H. Baird was remarkably still breathing and managed to reach a cabin over a mile away around 10 o'clock that morning. Mrs. Baird was sent for and hastened with all possible speed the distance of 18 miles over a very rough hilly road, but arrived about 5 minutes too late to see her husband alive, the Sacramento Bee later reported. Benjamin Baird had already died from his many wounds around 9 o'clock that night, leaving behind his devastated wife, Mary, and their 16 children. His ravaged corpse was then transported back to the family homestead, 4 miles north of the Rogue River, for burial. Benjamin's death became a family legend, despite the farmer having crossed the line between bravery and stupidity that fateful morning. In the early 20th century, his remains were eventually moved to the Pioneer Cemetery in Grants Pass. While B.H. Baird had provoked the aggression of a protective mother that morning in Oregon, the most ferocious grizzly bear to ever leave its paw prints in the California soil was probably the beast that killed 3 cowboys in a single day near the San Benito Ranch on August 18, 1870. The animal's unique tracks, having lost 3 of its toes 10 years earlier, had long been familiar to those living in the region southeast of San Jose. The horror began after 2 of the 3 ill-fated cowboys skipped breakfast to pursue a stray cow that summer morning. They headed up a ravine and dismounted when they spotted the stray lying among the brush. The 2 cowpunchers had initially believed the cow was sleeping and barely noticed its wounds when a massive grizzly with 3 missing toes emerged from behind the carcass. The bear swatted the closest man to the ground in a flash and ripped his abdomen open. The roaring beast then chased down the other cowpuncher, sank its teeth into his skull, and tore the wrangler's head completely from his body. The decapitated cowboy's friend managed to drag himself into a nearby brush with his entrails protruding through his blood-soaked shirt. The wounded cowboy then watched helplessly as their cohort arrived from camp a short time later to call them back for breakfast, only to be mauled to death by the particularly aggressive grizzly. The cowhands at the San Benito Ranch eventually realized some of their boys were missing and retrieved the 3 victims later that morning. The cowboy who had taken refuge in the brush survived long enough to detail what happened before inevitably succumbing to his wounds later that night. 3 men, whose names are unknown, who had been keeping a diary on the San Benito Ranch, came to their death in a most horrible manner, the San Francisco Examiner explained. Grizzly sports. For all the horrors endured by those who were killed by a bear on the frontier, the savagery of man was likewise inflicted upon the grizzlies of California. When bear hunters weren't killing the animals for the price of their furry pelts, some grizzlies were captured alive and subjected to participating in gladiatorial fights against other fearsome creatures in front of a crowd of onlookers. The Spanish conquistadors had brought the practice of bear baiting to the Americas many years before, and it remained a popular form of entertainment throughout most of the 19th century in California. The grizzly bears were often chained by their necks to an upright post and forced to fight for their lives against the large bulls or dogs pitted against them inside a pit or split-board arena. While many enjoyed the cruel spectacle, not all Californians approved of bear baiting. The Sacramento Bee condemned the practice as a barbarous pastime and a travesty on April 9, 1866. The most famous Californian fighting bear was Grizzly Joe. who was eventually purchased by businessman William Billings and taken on tour to demonstrate his fighting skills before rabid crowds in the Midwest during the 1860s. The celebrated Grizzly Joe had vanquished bulls in Omaha, Nebraska, and St. Joseph, Missouri, before his most publicized prize fight against a bull named Texas Johnny took place in St. Louis, Missouri, on December 25, 1867. A pretentious reporter from the Daily Missouri Republican was among the estimated 2,000 people in attendance at the Abbey track that Christmas afternoon and covered the event in every round as if it were the fight of the century. There was a fight between a bull and a bear. That was enough to set St. Louis agog. Near the judges' stand stood Texas Johnny, rearing his head like a fiery steed, but evidently aware that a stout rope attached to his right hind leg was a formidable barrier to too much locomotion, until a signal from the drum said a little more slack. Grizzly Joe was alike an object of great curiosity and no little anxiety among the betting gents as to how he would come out, whether or not the bear would take too many horns and get groggy, or the bull be unstable to bear it out. Joe looked as though he was the master of the situation as he complacently peeped through the bars of his cage and stretched out a paw, eager for the attack. Three stalwart men had been previously appointed to see fair play and hold the ropes that kept Joe and Johnny Bull in sage limits from the surveying crowd, the aforesaid referees, though everybody wanted to be boss, being also provided with sharp sticks to goad the animals, when necessary, into a frenzy of passion. At precisely 3:30 p.m., the band struck up Yankee Doodle and Bruin was let out, a moment of suspense to the gaping multitude. Texas Johnny was declared the winner following the ninth and final round that evening. The bear declined to fight, the Burlington Free Press lamented. Once he made a frantic rush for a small building just outside the fence and succeeded in climbing through the window in his fright, but was speedily hauled back by the rope. The Fighting Grizzly had retreated to his cage the moment the managers of the Moral Entertainment opened the door. Grizzly Joe had suffered enough wounds during his vicious exchanges with Texas Longhorn that his scheduled fight against two bulldogs in Chicago the following month had to be postponed. His owner, William Billings, was also failing to turn a profit. Grizzly Joe, the fighting bear of St. Louis, has eaten his owner bankrupt, the Greenville Advocate declared on January 9, 1868. An attachment was served on the letter a few days later for a debt of $56, the greater part of the debt for boarding Joe. Grizzly Joe had participated in his last prize fight that evening in St. Louis, Missouri. William Billings promptly sold the 900-pound animal to W.B. Gall of Ohio shortly after. Yesterday, there arrived in our city the great prize-fighting bear, announced the Cincinnati Times on March 28, 1868. W.B. Gall saw that the bear he had purchased was turned over to his new quarters in the vicinity of Brighton, where he will be carefully cared for. Those opposed to animal cruelty in frontier times hoped the famous Grizzly Joe would enjoy his retirement and a peaceful death in the Buckeye State. True West Magazine, December 2023 edition. Pioneer Pets. Dogs and cats are as Western as Six Guns and Stetsons, and a lot more lovable. In the Old West, dogs were common and necessary. Cats, not at first, but soon, were as essential to day-to-day living as fresh water and a cooking fire. Dogs have been roaming North America since at least 10,000 BC and were the most important domestic animal on the continent until the Spanish arrived with the horse. Cats, on the other hand, didn't arrive in the Western Hemisphere until they chased some rats off Christopher Columbus's Nina, Pinta, and Santa Maria somewhere in the Caribbean. Whether chasing rats, raccoons, bears, or mountain lions, or pulling a travoy, sled, or cart, dogs have truly been everybody's best friend in the West for time eternal. Cats, now they have a different story. Let's just say the old world cat became essential because the European invaders also brought rats. So all you cat haters out there, say a little thanks to the Toms and Tabbies who saved not just the West, but the larders and granaries of nations from Canada to Mexico. If you've got a bit of the humbug about this pet history stuff, sit back and soak in the smiles from all these men, women, boys, and girls with their beloved frontier pets. We bet you might soon remember the joy of the season and wonder of a brand new puppy or kitten. True West Magazine, December 2023 edition. Ask the Marshal by Marshall Trimble. Brushy Bill, Winchesters, and Whiskey Row. Question: did the U.S. Army find out who was selling rifles to the Lakota and Cheyenne Indians prior to the Battle of Little Bighorn? Joe Manriquez, Whittier, California. I ran this by Lee Noyes, former editor of the Custer Bakerfield Historical and Museum Association. He writes, to my knowledge, the federal government never prosecuted anyone for providing repeating or any other firearms and ammunition to the Lakota or Cheyenne tribes. This question has apparently not been researched, nor have the sources of these repeating firearms possessed by Native American warriors. What we do know is that many warriors possessed Henry and Model 1873 Winchester rifles at Little Bighorn, based on archaeological surveys at the National Monument since the 1980s. The data cited in my response were from Douglas D. Scott, Richard A. Fox, Melissa A. Connor, and Dick Harmon, Archaeological Perspectives on the Battle of the Little Bighorn, Norman and London, University of Oklahoma Press, 1989. Recommend reading articles. For example, Douglas D. Scott and Richard A. Fox, Jr., Archaeological Insights into the Custer Battle, an Assessment of the 1984 Field Season, University of Oklahoma Press, 1987. Question: what do we know about Wyatt Earp's first wife, Eurilla Sutherland? Lisa Walker, Birmingham, Alabama. Wyatt never talked about her. He probably met her in late 1869, just after he turned 22. Her gravestone indicates she was born in 1849. She was the daughter of a Lamar hotel keeper. She died about 9 months after the wedding, probably in childbirth, and perhaps of typhus. She's buried in Milford, Missouri. Question: if I walked into a bar on Whiskey Row in Prescott, Arizona territory in the late 1800s, what libations could I indulge in? Greg Williams, Apache Junction, Arizona. I ran this by Prescott's original Whiskey Row author, Brad Courtney, and here's what he had to say. At first blush, my thought is, obviously, whiskey. But it was the source of much Law and Order trouble. So Prescott became a beer mecca and was producing over one-third of the territory's beer. There was even talk of Prescott becoming the St. Louis of the West. In another direction, the Cabinet Saloon was creative at that time. In Prescott's original Whiskey Row, I wrote, the Cabinet offered fancy drinks. There was Gold Lion Whiskey, Mountaineers, Brandy Smashes, Wine on Ice, Cabinet Punches, Milk Punches, Imported Ginger Ale and Apollarius Water, Spring Water from Bad Nurnau, Germany. Kentucky whiskey was also all the rage at that time. Question: what are your thoughts on the claims that Brushy Bill Roberts was Billy the Kid? Was he? Roseanne Stone, Biloxi, Mississippi. In a word, no. The evidence is overwhelming that Billy was shot and killed by Pat Garrett at Fort Sumner, New Mexico. Brushy had gray eyes with yellow specks, while the Kid had clear blue eyes. Brushy had a square-shaped jaw, while the Kid's was rounder. The ears were completely different. Lastly, Billy's shoulders were much more sloped and narrower. Brushy was illiterate. The Kid was not. Lastly, Brushy's niece, Mrs. Geneva Pittman, said that Brushy's birth date, recorded in the family Bible, was 1879. Billy was in his teens by that time.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.